I'm lucky enough to be joined today by John Giddings. John is originally from St Albans, but has gone on to bigger and better things. I'm not going to try and speak for him. I wanted to say thank you for joining us here on Mix 92.6. John, you are originally from St Albans. I'll let you tell us about the interesting and varied career you've had subsequently. But tell us a little bit about your upbringing in St Albans, and then we'll go on from there.
It's a true story. I was born in 33 Batchford Drive, and I lived there for 18 years, I think it was. I first went to school in a Boyne Lodge, and then I went to Garden Fields, and then I went to St Albans School, where it all began.
St Albans School, and it's got, obviously, you know, you're now one of the famous alumni, which I think includes a Pope, Stephen Hawkins, and Tim Rice, who... maybe that's the best way to get onto the musical part of your career. So after leaving St Albans...
Hang on, what about Rod Argent and...
Yeah, sorry, the Zombies. Well, I think everyone knows that, don't they? You know, in terms of...
That's the Elias Band. Yeah. I went out with Rod's sister, who lived in High Oaks.
There you go. What do you remember... Not too far from me, actually. I'm just off High Oaks. What do you remember about living in St Albans back in the early days?
It was fantastic. We had a great time. We had a great gang of people. We used to meet up the town, go to the Blacksmith's Arms illegally, and just have a good time. It was a good bunch of people, and it was a great upbringing, and we were very keen on music. We used to go to London at the weekend and see all these bands playing, and go to Dunstable Queensway Hall. We never went to Friars. Friars used to do gigs at Dunstable, actually, but we saw loads of bands, saw Led Zeppelin in the Cherry Tree, Welling Garden City, went over on the bus, Pink Floyd at Parliament Hill Fields. It was great. It really was a good time.
I see. And you grew up with your mum and dad, I think your dad lived in Watford, was it? Or
My dad worked at Watford Town Hall. My mum was a cleaner at St Albans Museum, and she worked at the hospital over the hill from Batchford Drive. Trying to remember the name of the road. I can picture it. I can't remember.
Waverley Road, probably.
Waverley Road, yeah. You go over and down. Because yeah. One year, there was so much snow, someone skied down the hill there. It was incredible. It really impressed me. It was, I don't know, an 8-9-year-old, whatever I was.
So you grew up in St Albans. So then you moved down, I understand, to go to university in Exeter. And that's where things started to turn more, perhaps, into the music industry. What happened down there?
No, it happened before then, when I was 14. My friend Chris Hawke at school came to me and said, my group has split up. Why don't you learn to play bass? We'll pull a few chicks. I thought, I'm in. So I couldn't afford a guitar. I'm left-handed, so I had to learn upside down on other people's guitars. And he taught me a few riffs, Sunshine of Your Love, Jimi Hendrix stuff. And we were doing a gig at Harpenden Youth Club, and we were playing the Nile song by Pink Floyd. And there was no stage. A skinhead came and stood in front of me and said, if you don't effing stop playing now, I'm going to effing hit you. So we stopped and legged it. And there's a dawning realization when you play in a band, you're not actually a musician. I was better off booking the gig than actually being in it. And my friend John Fenton was social sec at the local college, St Albans College of Further Education. And he started promoting gigs at St Albans City Hall, which is now called the Alban Arena, hilarious because it's not an arena, it's a hall. It's like calling a stadium an arena. It's the wrong definition. And I found out that to get a job in the music business, you had to book groups and meet agents and transfer to the other end of the phone line. So I'm probably the only person you've ever met who went to university on the basis they wanted to be social secretary and get into the music business. So I put my hand over the courses and I looked at my A-levels, English, Geography, History, lifted it up, it said philosophy and sociology. I still don't know what they are, but I got to put on gigs and meet agents and blagged myself into the music business. At that time, the whole music business was full of social secs. The guy at Leeds was Paul Loseby, who manages Jules Holland and David Gilmour. Andy Murray, who worked with Pink Floyd, was at Leeds Poly. Nick Lee was at Bristol University. Paul King, who managed Tears for Fears, was at Brunel. We were all the same year of people.
So it was a big bit of a community. So that was the university years. So then things started to get somewhat more serious after that. It sounds like, looking certainly from what I've read on your previous interviews and on Wikipedia, it started some names that I'm sure our listeners will recognise. You started to get involved with.
I was lucky. I talked my way into a job at a company called MAM, and it was the summer of punk. And I rented a flat in West Kensington opposite a pub called the Nashville, which is now called the Three Kings or something. And I walked in, there was this group on stage, and the audience were jumping up and down like that. And the singer had on a Pink Floyd t-shirt with "I hate" written across it. I thought, how dare you hate Pink Floyd? They're my favorite group in the world. And they were called the Sex Pistols. And that was my first realization there was something going on in London. And, you know, punk groups. I signed the Stranglers, the Adverts, X-Ray Specs. Every group was playing every pub down the road and having hit singles like there was no tomorrow. It was the perfect time to enter the industry.
And what was maybe I'm leapfrogging to then, you one of the most famous things is that you were involved with David Bowie in Wembley Stadium in, I think it was the early 80s, 83,
Oh,
84.
that was a lot later. I mean, after the punk revolution, we went on to the New Romantics. And Spandau, Duran Duran. I had Alison Moyet, Paul Young, God, who else? Tears for Fears, Big Country, one of my favorite groups of all time. And they all had platinum albums, 1984 and 1985. So I decided that the only way to become big time was to plug into the American music business. So I sold half my company to a company called ITG in New York. Well, I started off at a company called MAM, and then I split. We formed a company called TBA International, 50-50. But I fell out with my partner, so I formed my own company called Solo, Solo, which is a musical term, obviously, and I was on my own. And so I sold half of Solo to an American company called ITG, and they looked after David Bowie, The Cure, Depeche Mode, Genesis, and they sent me a telex at the time asking me to see if I could get any dates at Wembley. And I sent them the dates back for Wembley Arena. And they sent me one back saying, no, we mean Wembley Stadium. I had heart failure. And so I booked Wembley Stadium for David Bowie. And I remember going up there and standing up there looking at the size of it, thinking, oh my God. My legs were shaking, it's the honest truth. And then I thought, sod it, it's just a bigger gig. You've got to deal with it and get on with it. And that was the start of it all, really. That plugged me into the big time with, you know, the people who had shares in the American company were involved in the Rolling Stones, David Bowie, Genesis. It all stepped up from there. And then in the 90s, I got the opportunity to get involved with the company Live Nation. Are now the biggest promoters in the world, and I've been a consultant to them ever since. So, I mean, in the last couple of years, we've done Lady Gaga, Beyoncé, we're setting up tours of the future, we've done Sting. You know, it goes on and on and on. And the interesting thing is, sadly, lots of these, I call them pop stars, they're rock gods, really. Are dying, and I'm not really sure who's replacing them because the way music comes now, you know, we used to go to the, what was it called, the Record Room in St Albans High Street and buy Tommy, for example, by The Who, and we'd take it home, four blokes, for a weekend and learn all of the lyrics to go with it. And kids nowadays just have streaming and hear one song as opposed to a whole album. You know, who's going to make the next Dark Side of the Moon? Or Tommy, or all those. I mean, I came up on prog rock, but I was lucky. My sister was a couple of years older than me. So she was into, you know, dance music, Martha and the Vandellas, the Supremes, and all of that. So I learned that at an early age at the same time, whereby the boys at school were really into John Mayall and Eric Clapton sitting on the cover reading the Beano. Remember that album cover? That's how it all happened, really. I've never had a real job.
I'm old enough to remember. Yeah, well, I don't even have to be that old enough to remember album covers and things like that. But I agree with you. It was a very tangible difference. You listen to the whole album, a lot, especially in prog rock. A lot of the albums had a very prescribed flow, right? There was a story being woven amongst the songs and that sort of stuff. And you're right in terms of, you know, how it's evolved as people just listen to one song and everyone gets very excited. I think Taylor Swift had a new song that came out that surpassed a billion views in record time or whatever it is. But it's very much in isolation. You don't have the tangible anticipation of a record cover or reading the sleeve. What was interesting, so you've given a hint to the more recent involvement you've had with music and stuff like that. But going back into those early days in the 80s, I mean, how do you think, I've read a lot of biographies of people that were, you know, whether it's people in Spandau Ballet or Duran Duran or in Guns N' Roses or any of that sort of stuff. And I'm a little bit jealous that I live in this era and I didn't live back then, you know, the days before. And before smartphones and various other things, you know, and a lot more money, right? You know, because it was said that you were selling physical records and touring was a sort of different thing. Touring now seems to be almost the fundamental moneymaker for a lot of artists. How have you seen it evolve from back then to doing it now in terms of the touring industry?
Well, it's a complete change. You know, it used to be based on what record companies thought and record releases, but artists make a lot of money from touring now because ticket prices have gone up substantially and record sales. I mean, to get a number one album, you only need 8,000 to 10,000 album sales. You know, with Paul Young in 1984, 1985, one day he sold 100,000 albums before Christmas. And we thought it was going to be like that for the rest of our lives. And then they invented CDs, which they told us didn't scratch. So we rebought our whole catalogue on CD, and then you could chuck them across the room and they would scratch. So you'd waste it. They cost twice as much as an album. And then it got destroyed by streaming, really. I mean, Spotify has got a lot to answer for. I can listen to anything for £9.99 a month.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, of course, you can listen to Mix 92.6 as well, playing all the favourite music. One of the things you're more famous for more recently is kind of resurrecting the Isle of Wight Festival. Obviously, it was very famous the first time round for having absolute legends there. How did that come about? And how did the first couple of years kind of trying to re-energise what was a... very famous music festival in terms of music lovers. How did that come about?
By complete accident, really, because I went there in 1970 and saw Jimi Hendrix and the Doors, which, you know, was part of our upbringing. I know going to a festival with them was left field, but unbelievably, we met up as a gang coming from separate destinations. We met up at a bay at midnight on the Isle of Wight amongst 600,000 people. There were no phones where you could change the arrangement or anything. And so 32 years later, because the Isle of Wight Festival got banned by an act of parliament, you could only have 5,000 people stay overnight on the island. And the council phoned everyone in the music business to resurrect the event. And everybody turned it down. And I only went down there for a laugh, really. I thought it'd be a nice day out of the office. And I remember sitting on the ferry, and the sun was shining on the Solent. And I thought, well, I book all my acts on other people's festivals. Why don't I have my own? So I did, the first year was the Charlatans and Robert Plant, a one-day event, plus the local council, £500,000. So they promptly gave the whole event to me. And then the second year, it was 2 days, I had... what's his name from the Jam, Paul, on that one night, and Brian Adams the second night, and I promptly lost £500,000 of my own money. And then the third year, I made it a three-day event. I must have been mad, actually. And it was Stereophonics, The Who, and David Bowie. We sold 35,000 tickets, and the rest was history. Yeah. But I only could have done it by being in the music business and people trusted me to pay them. It's all it's down to. You know, and the Isle of Wight has a fantastic, it was the Woodstock of Europe. If someone had asked me to start a festival in Cleethorpes or Hull, I mean, I'm not disrespecting them, I just wouldn't have bothered because it doesn't have that worldwide famous name.
And that's got on. That was 2002, wasn't it? So you've just gone past 20 years of doing it and it's getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah, this year was our 21st festival because we missed one for the pandemic. And the second year of the pandemic, we moved it from June to September and got away with it.
And so that's, you've just come off the back of that. That's why I've been struggling to get hold of you for the last couple of weeks, because you are a very busy man. But in terms of, you've kind of alluded to some of the more recent artists you've been dealing with. They do include the biggest, U2, Madonna, Celine Dion, some of these sort of people. What's the, you know, what's the planning stages? What's involved in terms of, you know, someone comes to you, assuming their management said, right, we want to put on a tour. How long a process is it for someone like you too, who might want to do 100, 200 dates?
Of that calibre, it takes 2 years. You've got to discuss where you want to play, whether you want to play indoor or open air, how much money you need to, you know, these productions get bigger and bigger and bigger. It's not the artists walking away with all the money. They're delivering an incredible show as entertainment. You know, I mean, I'm a Grand Prix follower, and the average ticket price for a Grand Prix worldwide is $750 now, and we're nowhere near that. But we do charge a decent amount to see Madonna this autumn, or Beyonce is just... But if anybody saw the Beyonce tour, they'll say it was worth it. It was phenomenal.
Yeah, it was definitely... I think the reports and the reviews, it was a performance. I mean, I've seen you two probably 6 or 7 different tours, and even the recent... You know, we went to Elton John last summer and Ed Sheeran, and it is the audiovisual experience. The lighting experience has always been important, even back to the Pink Floyd days, but it's become much more of a spectacle. The anticipation, I think, of people has gone up as well in terms of, you know, what they want to see, and the innovation, I guess, in the music business as well in terms of stage design.
They expect a certain level, and certainly at a festival, they expect better lews than there were in 1970.
Well, I think that's always going to be the perennial problem of trying to fix with festivals generally, isn't it? I know it's a long drop, I think, in Glastonbury. It's not very well liked. But what in terms of, in your career, dealing with more than household names, worldwide names, I mean, what would you say is one of your big best memories or most, immense, monumental occasions, or where you really just stood there and said, I can't believe this is my job?
Well, there's so many. I mean, I remember Genesis going on stage at Nebworth, and I was standing at the catering tent having a cup of tea, and the group was standing behind the stage set just about to go on, and they used to use The Farm as their intro altogether now. And just as they're about to go on, Phil turned around and gave a thumb up to me, and I cried. It comes up through up your back and it comes out through your eyes. It's to see that many people enjoying themselves and the realization that you've helped make it happen. I'm still proud of it and still surprised by it, you know?
Yeah, I think it's the power of so many people, because Nebworth typically has always had a fair amount. I mean, obviously you've had the Oasis gigs and Robbie Williams, and I think they can almost break records every time they put on a gig in Nebworth.
I saw the Floyd there, the Stones there, all those early day shows when it was a lot more... it wasn't as sophisticated running an event.
I'm sure our listeners would love to have more gigs back in there. Maybe not the people who live in Old Nebworth Village, but certainly the rest of us, because it's kind of handy for coming home. So.
I remember going up to the house, to Nebworth House, and saw the Lord and Lady, and they asked me if I wanted a tour of the house. And I said, that would be nice. So I went round and I thought, you should engage in conversation. So I said, have you got any ghosts? And the lady said, yes, we have. I said, do you ever speak to them? She said, yes, I do. I stupidly said, what about? And she said, that's none of your business.
You're a very busy man, so I really thank you for spending some time with us here on Mix 92.6. I've got a question that I've got to ask, because there's going to be people listening. You know, they may be middle-aged and want to get in the business, or they may be younger, and we're a big fan here of promoting, you know, local artists, new artists hitting the scene. What word of advice would you give to someone want to get in? And I'll say the music industry, not necessarily specifically in tour promotion, because there's lots of different careers within the industry. What advice would you give someone listening is like, I really want to get in, you know, I've been to tours, I want to get part of it?
Work hard, get your foot in the door, get to know someone who's putting on a local gig. You know, it becomes, people start off, you've got to graft, you've got to work your way in, you've got to go to the local pub, help put on gigs, learn your craft. I mean, I started off by putting on gigs at university. I didn't have a clue what I was doing, but I had a local newspaper. I remember operating a spotlight. You just got to have, It's about grafting, you know. I've given speeches at the Brit School, and kids come up to me afterwards and say, I want your job. And it's like, but you need to live for 50 years before you can have my job, you know. It's through experience, and just treat people how you expect to be treated. Be nice to people. Don't become big time. Just bloody work hard and do your job properly. It's not Brain of Britain stuff. It's simple and straightforward. And just don't get beyond, don't get too big for your own boots. We're the only business in the world that pays people hundreds of millions of dollars and they still let them tell us what to do.
Thank you ever so much, John. Thanks for spending the time. As always, it's your privilege to lead us out. I'll let you suggest what song you'd like us to finish off the interview.
You have to play Heroes by David Bowie, one of my favourite all-time artists. Working with him was a joy, a pleasure, and I'm so proud to have been there.
Fantastic. Well, here is Heroes by David Bowie, and thanks again, John.